Scott Hughes, Rick Horton.
This is a season like no other.
Unbelievable start from Hamilton.
He's just insane.
Oh, and touch! Verstappen is into the lead.
Come on.
This is the F1 Podcast. Two soft compounds.
Very dramatic start again. Very exciting. I do get riled up with this new intro.
you want to punch someone, don't you?
I don't know about that.
You want to do a Will Smith.
But I get very excited. I'm like, oh, I'm all excited. I'm ready to go. I don't know why I went all camp there either. But what another great race weekend it was. I'm a big fan of this Saudi track, you know. It's a bit dangerous, obviously, but I think it's just that, like, the fact that it's like a Monaco, but a fast kind of street Monaco, it's got a lot of good things about it. I mean, it is dangerous, and I do think they need to make some changes for next year. You know, Schumacher's crash was unbelievable, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely one of my favourite tracks of the season now. Whether they race there again, we're not sure because of the controversy that surrounded the event this year. The drivers have asked for more clarity on different races and venues that they go to in the future, and they had a six-hour meeting on Saturday before the race. Didn't finish till 2 a.m. that meeting, with the drivers discussing whether they should race or not in Saudi Arabia. But, yeah, the track itself, I think, is really good. It's a real challenge for the drivers. And as we saw with Mick Schumacher, $1 million worth of damage he did to that Haas car. He did $1 million worth of damage to the Haas car at the same event last season, and $500,000 of damage in Monaco. He's proving to be an expensive driver for the Haas team.
Yeah, and that's the thing, isn't it? When you have an accident like that and they look at those numbers and they think, you know, that's, you know, £2-3 million worth of accident damage, you know, I'm not surprised they didn't race, to be honest, because they had to kind of rebuild that car, and that's a lot of money, like you say. And with regards to, you know, the events that happen with the attack over there and stuff like that, this is the thing, isn't it? When you race in certain countries and certain places around the world, you know, some of this stuff will happen, and this is where they need to work out if, you know, is it worth going to these places for the risk of the drivers? And of course, you've got the media people, you know, there's a lot of staff and a lot of people that head over there with Formula One and the whole entire circus going over there. And you don't, of course, want to put anybody's life at risk, whether that be a driver on the track or anybody that's there just doing their job, you know, media or, you know, people that are in hospitality or any, you know, mechanics, you know, there's all sorts of people that go over there, hundreds of thousands of people, you know, and they just need to make sure that everyone's safe and they're going to venues that are great tracks, but also safe for everybody involved. So like you say, whether we'll be back there or not, I don't know, but it is a great track. And one thing I love about this season so far, you know, the first race I thought this could be a fluke, but it's happened again on the second race. These new cars are like go-karts, aren't they? You know, you overtake and you can overtake again and they can then get you back. And it's brilliant because we're getting some proper racing. And what was very interesting for me, I think, when Verstappen got in the lead of this race and he was on his radio and he was very panicky on his radio because he's like, he's closed up behind the virtual safety car. This is not fair. This is not fair. Because he knows that he can now pass him. And it was just interesting. I thought that the drivers are getting a bit jittery because you can legitimately overtake now.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting the way they were both playing for the DRS line, the activation line. So going down the back straight, they were both, neither of them wanted to get to that DRS activation line before the other, which I thought is an interesting new tactic, because of course DRS is so powerful now with these cars that are easier to follow anyway. The DRS, you know, renders the car in front absolutely useless from attack from behind when the power units are so equally matched as they are with the Red Bull powertrain and the Ferrari power unit this year. I thought it was great that the drivers waved at each other as they were on the warm down lap, and they, even Charles Leclerc went, you know what, well done to Max, what a brilliant race that was, even though he was disappointed to finish second. And the closeness of the cars, in fact, throughout the field, has just been brilliant. The two Alpine cars really going at it in the early stages of the race, trying to get the best of each other, I thought was just great. So when they said, or they promised us, closer racing, they weren't lying, were they?
Yeah, and like you said, the great thing about that was the team were like, no, they're free to race. You know, the Alpine team, this is, you know, they're free to race, crack on. You know, this, we're early in the season. And so that's great that the teams are letting their drivers race and they're not putting any sort of team orders in as well. I did see something online about DRS and I thought, what a great idea. I wonder why they've never done this. And you might have seen this yourself, but a guy was basically suggesting with the DRS, he said, we're now getting into a realm where, like you just mentioned, it's a bit dangerous because we've got a DRS line that the drivers don't want to pass first because they're then obviously not going to get the DRS. DRS, or they are going to get the DRS. So this line now becomes a bit of a battleground. And as we saw with Max and Charles, they lock up and it's dangerous because they're hammering the brakes. They're really locking these cars up to not go over that line first. So this guy was suggesting, he said, keep DRS as it is, but don't have an actual activation line. He said, why don't you do something like give them 10 or 15 or 20 DRSs per race? So it's almost like the push to pass thing that they have in Formula E, where, you know, you almost get a button where you can decide where you use your DRS, whether that be to overtake or to defend, but it's your choice when you open your DRS, but you only have a certain amount per race. So the drivers are going to go, right, I've got 20 presses of this button. I need to save some for some overtaking later on or for some defending later on. But if you use them all up in the first 10 laps, you know, that's you've used them up. So if the guy overtakes you because he's got DRS, and that would kind of make it a bit of a tactical thing as well, where they're kind of using the DRS, you know, to not only get past or to defend, but tactically they've got to use it cleverly. And, you know, if you had that sort of thing in a kart race where you're like, look, this is a 50-lap race, you know, if I've got 15 pushes of this button, I'm not going to use them in the first, you know, I want to use as little as I can early on, so I've got options later on in the race, you know, and it would just make things another level of exciting again. So I thought that was an interesting idea. I do think something with the DRS will happen where there'll be some slight tweaks, because I do think, you know, it is becoming slightly dangerous now when they won't pass this line.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, push to pass has always been a thing in IndyCar racing. And I suppose Formula One does have a push to pass button, really, which is what the boost they get from the charge of the battery. So if they're on an attacking lap, they'll recharge their battery, harvest the energy towards the end of the lap before, and then release that extra battery power as they're trying to overtake in the following lap. So DRS is a little bit different to that, obviously. But I think you're right, it does need a tweak. Someone else suggested on Twitter, why, you know, instead of being within a second of the driver, if you are within a second, then don't have DRS available. But if you're between 2 and 3 seconds behind, then... Do activate it. Do you know what I mean? So I think you're right. It'll probably be tweaked a little bit as the season goes on, because we are going to start seeing a lot of this jostling for position as they approach the DRS line. Apologies, by the way, for the lateness of the podcast this week. I'd like to say, you know, in Hollywood circles, it was because of scheduling difficulties, which it was, but, you know, we're not that showbiz. So, you know, just one of those things. I said to Scott, can we do it Tuesday? He went, nah. And I went... Wednesday, and I went, nah. Thursday, I could do it. Yeah, all right. Yeah, we'll do it Thursday. That was exactly how it was. But that has meant that we've been able to wake up to the news this morning that Formula One is going to race in Las Vegas from next year. The track layout and design looks absolutely pants.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it briefly this morning when I got up. Now, here's the thing. If you add Formula One and Vegas together, that's probably my favourite place in the world and probably my favourite sport in the world. Yeah. Add them together, that is a combination for me. And of course, it's going to be a Saturday night race, which is bizarre, because obviously in Vegas itself will be brilliant, because if you're out there, you can have a drink in the day and you can watch the race, and, you know, that'll be a great thing. I think for the UK audience, it means we're going to get it at a bizarre time of day. But, you know, the actual event itself, if you're in Las Vegas, that will be tremendous. Now, my only concern is we're getting rid of quite a few of the European tracks. You know, there's some good European tracks that we're getting rid of. And then they're moving to, this will be the third race in America, won't it? And traditionally, of course, Formula One's not been that big over there. Netflix has changed that a bit. I'm concerned that they're not going to get that much audience to Miami, Vegas, and Austin, Texas as well. I mean, that's a lot of fans that need to go to those places. But each of those venues, I'm looking forward to the Miami one this year. Yep. And, you know, the Vegas race as a spectacle will be tremendous. I fear it'll be a bit like Monaco, where the spectacle's great, you know, the actual kind of atmosphere around the race, and to watch it, to be there, to be part of it will be amazing, but the actual race itself will be a bit pants, because like you say, you know, they do go along the strip, don't they, for some of it, but some of it's also going to be around the back. And I think they've got like a big wheel, haven't they, in Vegas, and they're saying if you're on that wheel, you'll be able to see a 360 degree view of the race. So, you know, imagine the cost to be on that wheel during a race. It must be astronomical. But yeah, I feel like it's a spectacle thing rather than it's going to be a great track. We might be proved wrong, but...
Well, yeah, the main straight is the strip, and then there's a few wiggly bits behind the strip. But, you know, the track layout looks very, very basic to me. But it's a perfect match, isn't it? Vegas and Formula One, now that it's popular again in America. It's the perfect... I mean, Vegas will absolutely love the attention it brings them, and the tourism, of course. And Formula One will love the glitz and the glory of the Strip and Las Vegas and the neon and all of that. I mean, it's just it's a perfect no-brainer to me that they should be racing there. Weirdly, Saturday night race means that we probably won't get it until 2 or 3 a.m. Because they're 8 hours behind the UK. So for the European audience, it's going to be a bit of a bummer, I suppose. But, you know, for the American audience, and clearly the Netflix Drive to Survive success has pushed the sport in America. You know, it's a big one for Formula One to be there. And like you say, three races in America can only be a good thing for the sport, I think.
Yeah, it'll bring money in as well. I saw something on Twitter this morning where I think it was the mayor of Vegas said they're expecting this race to bring $500 million in each time they stage it. So if you're talking that kind of money, I mean, I know money is, you know, Vegas is enormous money anyway, and there's meant to be billions of dollars buried underneath Vegas in all the vaults and stuff, but $500 million across a race weekend, you know. You sometimes wonder why these venues are so keen to sign these contracts and get these races, but if you're bringing that kind of money into a city over a weekend, I mean, that's astronomical, isn't it? $500 million.
Yeah. Got some controversy on the grid after the Jeddah Grand Prix. Apparently, all is not well at Aston Martin. And there's been people speaking out about this in the last couple of days. Colin Coles has blamed Lawrence Stroll for Aston Martin's poor results and reckons that Sebastian Vettel wants out of the team and that he possibly could have raced in Jeddah but decided not to. And Ralf Schumacher has been talking and saying that Aston Martin should stick with Nico Hülkenberg. After two impressive drives at the start of the season, he reckons if Vettel wants to go, let him go and stick with Nico Hülkenberg. But we heard these rumours last season, didn't we, that Lawrence Stroll was running that team with an iron fist, and he was, you know, he was getting under the skin of a lot of the mechanics and engineers and designers, and he was demanding the best. And obviously they had some poor results last year, and this year has probably started even more badly for them, that he is not a happy man and he's taking it out on his team.
Yeah, I mean, two of the most frustrating things about the grid this year is the two cars that I think look the best are the McLaren and the Aston Martin in terms of colours of the cars and the way the cars just look. I think the McLaren just looks tremendous with the orange and the blue, and the Aston Martin, again, with the Aston Martin Racing Green. And it's just sad that those two brands are, you know, really on the back foot, really struggling. McLaren had a slightly better race this time round, but still not great. They're not up there. And the Aston Martins, you know, really struggling. When you sort of see the Alfa Romeo has come on like they have, and you look at the Aston Martins, you think, well, they've gone backwards, if anything. And it's a shame because it's an iconic brand, it's an iconic name. You know, the car looks brilliant, it looks fast, and it's just not. You know, so yeah, shame, like you say. And is that because, you know, we live in a world now where everything's a bit more transparent, isn't it? And I think if you are being ruled by an iron fist and it's very old school types of management, A, not many people put up with that, as we've seen, you know, quite a few people tend to leave ASAP. And B, it's just, I don't think it works anymore. I don't think, you know, we've come to a place in life where, you know, nobody wants to be bullied or pressured into working like that. You know, that's not a nice, you know, so people seek out a nice working environment. They go, you know, where's a team where I'm going to be happy and I can have a laugh and I can enjoy my job as well as do the job, you know. And I think sometimes Formula One gets very serious and, you know, there's lots of money involved. It's a very expensive thing to be involved in. Obviously, they want profit at the end of the year. They want to do as good as they can. And if there's any manufacturers involved, they want to do good so they can get some big money at the end of it and look good so they sell more road cars and stuff. So I understand it's high pressure business. But at the same time, you know, we are all human beings. We like to be treated nice. We like to, you know, have a bit of a laugh at work and enjoy ourselves. And I think if you're involved in something like Formula One, you're obviously a big petrol head, you're a racer, you want to win, you're competitive, you know, and to have a nice atmosphere around you. I get the feeling the Red Bull team is very sort of chummy, and that, you know, when they're dismantling the garage and stuff, they always have music on, don't they? And they seem to enjoy themselves. And the Ferrari team, they seem to enjoy their success, you know. So it's just a shame when you see these teams. I think when you add the pressure of not winning on top of that, it just adds to that horrible atmosphere that's growing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know for sure, of course, but Colin Coles worked for the team for some time and left, but he said it won't work anymore. You have a team owner who thinks he's team boss. He knows everything better than everyone else and thinks he should put his son up front with all his might. For me, it's completely the wrong approach. the fish always stinks from the head, and I can see the racing team going absolutely nowhere. And of course, Otmar Szafnár.
He's not sitting on the fence there, is he?
No.
Wow.
Otmar left the team in January, didn't he? And he said when he left that Lawrence Stroll's micromanagement was the main reasons for his departure. He couldn't handle it anymore because he was getting stuck in and involved. And as we've seen, I mean, the most amazing thing for me was that Nico Hülkenberg, in his first two races back for Formula One in over 18 months, out-qualified and out-raced Lance Stroll in both races.
He's a great driver, Hülkenberg. I'm surprised he's never had a better opportunity. You know, he's one of those drivers that's always been up there. He's a very solid driver in anything he's in. But unfortunately for him, he's another one of these drivers that always seems to end up in a sort of subpar machinery. He's never been in a great car. He's never, you know, it's the Alonso effect, isn't it? He's always gone to the wrong team at the wrong time. And, you know, Alonso, in theory, could be a 5-, 6-, 7-time world champion by now had he made the moves that Hamilton's made. And he just made the wrong moves at the wrong time. And that's what Hülkenberg's done. He's done the same thing. And then he's ended up kind of just in the wilderness because the team's struggling a bit. So they changed drivers thinking that's the issue. And, you know, a lot of it is timing in Formula One, isn't it? If you get the right team at the right time, you know, look at the Ferrari guys. They join a team like Ferrari hoping that one day they'll be good. The rule change comes in, and look at the Ferrari. It's absolutely on fire. It's looking absolutely brilliant this season, which is great to see.
And the Mercedes woes continued in Jeddah. Their power unit just clearly isn't up to the pace of the Ferrari-powered teams and the Red Bull powertrain. This is a problem that's not going to go away, by the way, because they are not allowed to change components in their power units until 2025. So that means Mercedes, if they've got this power unit that just isn't competitive, and we've seen with all the Mercedes powered cars so far this season that they're always towards the back of the grid, then no matter what aero work they do on those cars, the power unit is obviously the thing that makes it go. And if that's inferior, then it's going to stay inferior until the rule change in 2025. So they're going to have to stick with this power unit for 3 years.
Yeah, and that is a long time, like you say. And the Mercedes power unit, just, it's bizarre because it was always well up there, wasn't it? And again, talking about timing, you look at the McLaren team. Oh. You know, they had the wrong engine at the wrong time, so they changed, didn't they? They changed to the Renault engine, which wasn't right, and then they went into a Renault engine lull. So then they left Renault and joined Mercedes and got the better engine from Renault to Mercedes, and then Mercedes is now hitting a lull, and it's like they just picked the wrong engine at the wrong time, and they've had the same issue again there.
Well, yeah, look, I mean, they were Mercedes power for many years when McLaren was successful. Then they switched to Honda power when Honda re-entered Formula One. And that was an absolutely woeful experience when we had, the two McLarens running round at the very rear of the field. Then they switched to Renault and they thought that was going to be good. The Renault power unit wasn't great. Then they switched to Mercedes. They got the benefits last year and the year before from the Mercedes power unit because at one stage they finished third in the championship. But now they switched to Mercedes, or they've stuck with Mercedes. It's just not getting them anywhere, is it?
No, exactly. And it's just fascinating. When you see the practice times from Saudi, there was a lot. I think the entire bottom half of the field were all Mercedes runners, weren't they? Mercedes engine cars. And it's just bizarre to kind of see that. You think, well, what's changed so much here? That, you know, that was a cracking power unit last year. And all of a sudden, it's properly on the back foot.
It just shows you that Lewis Hamilton is not used to finishing 10th when he gets on the radio at the end of the race and says, do you even get points for finishing in 10th? He's definitely used to being on the podium and used to winning races. But it makes it interesting for me that you know, you've got a driver the caliber of Lewis Hamilton, 7 times world championship, now racing on a weekly basis with the likes of Haas. It's just bizarre, but it's great for the spectacle of Formula One, I think.
Yeah, and the other thing I've noticed this year, which is great, I think last year obviously it was Max versus Hamilton, and that was a great battle. But you know, Carlos Sainz was very good in the Ferrari last year and almost outdrove Charles Leclerc, I think, last year. I think Carlos had a better season. And then the cars have changed, and now it's Carlos that's struggling with this new car. And as we know, he went from, you know, one car to the McLaren, drove brilliantly, went from the McLaren to the Ferrari and drove brilliantly. You know, he's one of those drivers that can adjust very well. I've always thought he's very underrated, Carlos Sainz. And he's got into this new Ferrari, and he's struggling. He's up there, but he's not driving it as easily as Charles Leclerc is. And I found, like, this weekend, Max is struggling a bit as well, whereas Perez is driving the car better. It almost suits Perez a bit better than it does Max. And now you've got Max and Carlos, who are the two that are frustrated a little bit. And you've got the other two, Perez and Charles Leclerc, that are driving better, and it's, you know, come to them a lot quicker. So it's fascinating that they can tweak these cars in the smallest of ways, and certain drivers will just capitalise and drive better and love it. Other drivers really struggle with it.
Yes, let's get some stats, shall we, from the second round of the Formula One season. It was Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Nikki from At Lights Out has everything you need.
Perez ends the longest ever wait for pole. Verstappen wins for a seventh consecutive season, and only 18 drivers start for the first time in 7 years. Here are the top statistics from the 2022 Saudi Arabian Grand Prix weekend. We start this week with Jeddah pole sitter Sergio Perez. The driver of car number 11 took his first pole 11 years to the day since his first F1 qualifying appearance at the 2011 Australian Grand Prix. Becoming the first Mexican driver to take pole in F1, he set a new record for the most race appearances before a driver's first pole position. This was Perez's 215th race weekend appearance. The previous record was 130 races before pole for Mark Webber, who recorded his first pole, also with Red Bull, at the 2009 German Grand Prix. Perez failed to win the race, making him the seventh consecutive driver who failed to convert their maiden pole into a win. The last driver who was successful in doing so was Pastor Maldonado at the 2012 Spanish Grand Prix. Max Verstappen won the race, recording the 21st victory of his career. It sees him equal Kimi Raikkonen for 15th in the all-time list of most Formula One wins. Verstappen's victory was the first for car number one since Sebastian Vettel's win at the 2013 Brazilian Grand Prix, making it the longest gap between wins for car one in F1 history. Verstappen became the ninth driver to have won in seven consecutive F1 seasons and overtook Nelson Piquet for 11th in the all-time podium list and overtook Michael Schumacher for 7th in the list of F1's most prolific point scorers. The two Ferrari drivers joined Verstappen on the podium. With third place, Carlos Sainz became only the fifth driver to finish 31 consecutive races. Incredibly, this is only the second time that Ferrari have finished on the podium with both cars at two successive races in the past 13 years. The only other time that they've done it since the end of the 2008 season was at the 2018 Austrian and British Grand Prix. Next up, Lewis Hamilton, who recorded a surprising Q1 exit. It was the first time that Hamilton was eliminated in Q1 since the 2017 Brazilian Grand Prix, as well as the first time that he's failed to reach Q3 since the 2018 German Grand Prix. This was only the ninth Q1 elimination of Hamilton's career. The last time he was eliminated in Q1 on pure pace alone, with no other contributing factors, was at the 2009 British Grand Prix. And finally, two drivers failed to start the race. Mick Schumacher was ruled out after his qualifying crash, while Yuki Tsunoda stopped on his way to the grid. That made it the first time an F1 race has had only 18 starters since the 2015 Australian Grand Prix. With a further 5 drivers failing to finish, only 13 drivers reached the chequered flag. It's the fewest number of finishes since 12 drivers crossed the line at the 2020 Tuscan Grand Prix.
Thank you, Nicky. Don't forget, of course, you can follow him across the race weekends at Lights Out, is where you can find him on Twitter. And he's got some just brilliant facts and stats across. Oh, I can never say facts and stats, can I? Facts and stats across the race weekends. It's brilliant. Next up, of course, is the Australian Grand Prix. Now, that's not happening this weekend. That is the weekend after. So we'll review that properly next week on the podcast.
We will we'll preview it. They've made some changes to the Australian track. They've opened up some of the corners. Whether that's going to make it better or worse. We'll have to wait and see. But yes, we will be here at our regular time of Tuesday next week on the podcast after scheduling conflicts have been resolved. Until then, take care of yourself and we'll see you next week.
Follow Two Soft Compounds on Twitter and Facebook. Search for Two Soft Compounds. Two Soft Compounds is a talk about media production. All opinions are our own.